Succession number 28639, reel 5.
Sorry, Jack, go on, yeah. And were you, and that you were really disabled by that, I mean?
Oh, yes, I was. I was. The Dr. Jackson, of course, took me in his charge, and we hadn't moved to the hospital by this stage, by the way. We were still in the Itchioka camp, because I'm going back on a bit. And we're still in the Osaka camp, rather, when this happened. So he took me into the little sick bay he had in the camp, and after a few hours, with whatever he did to me, I was feeling a bit better. And it was soon after that, they were put on the transport then, the six of us, and taken to this hospital, so-called. When we got there, it was an old American baseball ground, which they used, apparently, during the pre-war days. Well, Japan apparently played a little bit of baseball with the Americans who were in Japan at the time before the war. And there was this little, what you would call, grandstand. All it was really was concrete steps from the ground up to about 20 feet. And the underground part was empty. It was just a grandstand, really. Just our steps, our concrete steps. And the first job we had to do was to barricade. We brought wood and Japanese joiners who helped us. And they just barricaded the whole thing in. And that was our camp, so-called hospital. This area of grandstand was a hospital. And the barbed wire was put round with 6 feet barbed wire with barbed wire all round the area of the baseball ground, which was about the size of a football pitch, if that. And that was our camp. Now, one end of the other, of the underground, was bricked up with two cauldrons in it. That was our kitchen. The other end was, at the moment, to be the hospital, so-called, in the camp. The last part was for the staffing, if there was any staff, or the wards. Little did we know at the time that the reason for this so-called hospital was the guards, the commandants on all the camps around the industrial area of Osaka had a meeting. And because of the number of workers that was decreasing, because of the number of sick that was increasing and the number of deaths increasing, they are having to report this to their superiors. And they decided to set up a so-called hospital, which was just a minority, to get rid of the sick so that they could say, on the percentage of working force we have 80% or 90% working still. And we're told that afterward. So as the transports arrived from the various camps, the first job we had to do was get onto the lorry with the Dr. Jackson and sort out the living from the dead. And the dead was just human skeleton, really. Mostly Americans, because they were coming from American camps. And they were normally very thin Americans. And they were even thinner than we were. They were just human skeletons. And
this is because they'd been under a harsher regime.
Probably. I never did know, but they were then put on beds, and we just allowed them to die there. And this so-called hospital, the opposite end from the kitchen, became our morgue, because we just weren't allowed to bury our dead. We just had to put them on top of each other, and no time at all it became rat infested. So those rats, it was quite common to wake up during the night and find a rat on your chest. And just looking at it, you just knock it off with your hand. Quite common practice. That was typical. Now, that happened now right up until late 44.
And you
44. So we're in there for the best part of a year.
You must have done something with the corpses. You didn't have corpses sitting there for a year, surely.
Yes, we did. Right, that got to such an extent that Jackson, towards the middle of the second of the 43 year, he had to see a doctor, a Japanese doctor, which had eventually been brought into the camp, because the number of times the doctors had objected to this. And by this time, by the way, we had been joined by Americans, including doctors. There were three American doctors, I recall, had also joined us to help out Dr. Jackson. And Dr. Jackson, by the way, was eventually taken out of the camp because the Japanese believed that during the time he was in charge of the so-called hospital, doing the things I've just explained, they were afraid he was keeping a diary So they took him out of the... They searched all the areas he'd accommodated while he was in the Ichioka camp. And then they took him out of the camp. We thought they'd taken him out to get rid of him. But we found out, no, they hadn't. They'd taken him out just because to interrogate him further and put him in another camp in case he hadn't been keeping diaries. So, well, but this time, the Japs were getting worried about the outcome of the war, you see.
Exactly, so they were beginning
to think...
beginning
to change slightly.
One question I've wanted to ask you for some time is, what about the Geneva Convention? Was there...
Oh, the number of times that they got so fed up, even on the Lisbon Maru, they got so fed up asking them unless they just didn't bother anymore because it didn't matter. They just ignored it.
You got nothing like Red Cross
parcels? No, just not at all. To the extent that during this place in this Ichioka camp, when Jackson eventually persuaded them, they had to get rid of these corpses, otherwise the Japanese guards would die as well, and the surrounding population, because there was people living around this camp, Japanese civilians. So we were given soya bean barrels about the size of that coffee table and about the height of it.
So it's about
the size of a normal coffee bean barrel. Now, we were told to put two bodies in one of these. Well, we tried it at first. It was impossible to do this. It's because we were breaking arms and legs to get these skeletons in there. And it was quite horrific for us to have to do this. And the doctors kept complaining about this. This is awful. We can't expect people to do this. And in the end, there was one to a barrel. But then we had to load them onto transport. And two or three of us went with a guard. And we just piled them up on a piece of waste ground and poured kerosene over them. And they reckoned that they were keeping the ashes of this. I don't believe they did. Because later on in the camp life, they saw these white so-called little coffins that were supposed to be remains of these of British or American prisoners. No way were they the Japanese. Were they the ashes of any of our survivors or dead prisoners of war. No way were they that. So same when I went round to Yokohama prison afterwards, later in life, and I saw these grave houses. These ashes are not the people that have got them, but still they've got a grave and there was a name on them and number. And I saw some of the headstones of some of my old pals that were only 16, 17, 18 years of age. Quite incredible when you think of it, really.
Were records kept so that you knew, I mean, Dr. Jackson?
Not to my knowledge.
Name,
not.
Rank,
he
someone
tried,
who died? Or...
No. Best of my knowledge, I'll come to that in a bit, which came to that afterwards. There was a bit of that. But I know some of the doctors. I know that Dr. Burley, an American doctor, kept some, and he managed to get them home. Whatever happened to them, I'll never know. I'm still in contact with this Dr. Burley. He's in his 90s now, and he's still alive, American doctor. My wife and I have been over to him over the years. They invited us over to his house in over there, a palatial house he had over there. So I'm still in touch with him. But anyway, this Ichioka camp, we were there right up until the bombing of Japan proper.
Right.
And that was when... any questions you want to ask on Ichioka before I leave it?
The hospital, you mean?
The hospital, yeah. So-called.
Was there any medication?
No,
were there any
we
drugs?
Had no medication.
Nothing.
No, we're no medics whatsoever. We had huge ulcers, and the only way they could treat these ulcers was to ask us, when we were out on the occasional working party, was to see if we could find maggots. Any maggots we could see, bring them in. And put them in any tin or anything that we could hold them in. And they used these to put them into the wounds and then strapped any old shirts or something around the wounds and left the ashes, the maggots to clean the wound out. And that was the only way they could do it. That was the only medics we had. And on gangrene, we had a lot of gangrene, by the way. It was awful, gangrene. That started out frostbite during the winter months. You had to put itchy hands and itchy feet. We used to call it, look at the lack of vitamins. And the only way they could get it during the winter was to get ease and get to sleep was to put their hands in the snow or their feet in the snow. And the doctors kept telling them that would create frostbite. But they just ignored that. And of course, frostbite set in and then gangrene. And when gangrene, the arm or the hand or the leg had to come off. And they had nothing, no instrument to do this. So the doctors said, when you're out on working parties, in addition to getting maggots, could you find out pieces of a hatchet or hacksaw or anything like that? So we find some hacksaw blade, but we never did find a hacksaw. Plenty of blades, but no hacksaw. So they just used the blades. And we found a couple of, this is in this Ichioka camp, we found a couple of old axes, which we had to sharpen ourselves for the doctors. And that's how they took out legs and arms. And we had to hold them down, because no anaesthetics, until they passed out. And I'll never forget when they took off one leg, because I was helping in this operation. They took the skin off. It was the leg to come off above the knee. Gangrene set in right up to the knee. So the whole leg had to come off above the knee, above the other knee. So they took the skin all the way around it with an old razor blade. And I'll come to how we sterilized them in a minute too. They pulled the skin up just like skinning an apple, a banana, right up over the knee. Red flesh with steaming and blood coming out. And they cut it off, and then when they took it off, just pulled the skin back and tied it on a knot under the knee. That was how they operated on it.
With no anaesthetic or anything,
no,
of course.
No.
And the man screaming in agony.
No. It was awful, yeah. No, that's typical of what happened in that Ichioka camp.
And the transports still continue to arrive from
the camps? Yes, all that time they were still coming in.
People dying?
Yeah, all the time. And we still never did get to ground zero, you might say, in our mortuary, because as soon as they cleared them, they were just piling up again. And the rats, of course, was always there waiting for them, and picking off what was left of flesh and the bones.
And what kind of rations did you have there?
600 grams of rice a day, with two fish heads per person. And I'll tell you, on the odd occasion, when even with the staff of this so-called hospital, the Americans particularly were worse than we were on this occasion. I don't know why, I've never been able to find out. But the American so-called staff in this hospital, so-called, because they're all people like ourselves, just POWs, if you dropped an eye out of a fish, there was a scramble for that in the ground. You used to tear each other to pieces to get that one eye, just to eat it. Because you used to eat fish, what do they call them? Plant heads. Plant heads, anything. Cats, we used to kill cats in this camp. If we could see a cat, we got hold of it, and we killed it and skinned it and boiled it, and it took ages to boil, but we boiled it somehow in this camp, in this big urn that we had as a so-called kitchen. Because the one thing by this time, the guards wouldn't come near us without mouth masks, because they were afraid of disease by this time, because we were all so evil-looking ourselves. We were skeletons and weak and awful-looking, really, and the guards were aware of this. So they wouldn't come into the camp there. They kept outside the Ichioka camp. When they came in with the rifles, they came in with masks and what have you. So that's what went on, really, until we were eventually bombed out of there. And we were...
Right, okay, I'm just thinking...
Before you leave at Ichioka.
Yeah, what else can I... I mean, again, there was no contact with civilians. I mean,
no,
in
Ichioka camp, we had no civilians. In fact, we went out working parties.
What would you do on these working parties?
Working parties? Well, that was another thing. As an orderly, I had to go into Ichioka with a transport and get the rations, so-called rations, you had 6 sack of rice. And this is very interesting, because let you see what I had to live on. We were taken in at 5 o'clock in the morning to a go-down in the Osaka docks. And from 5 o'clock till about midday, we spent the morning shoveling lovely white rice into sacks and unloading them onto Japanese transport for the various Japanese military establishments, hospitals and what have you. And towards midday, we were just about finished. So I had to sweep the remains of that go-down, even the corners, which had mildew rice on it. We had to sweep that into a heap, and that was our ration. We had to shovel it into sacks, to the extent that when we got it back, it was full of fag ends and cigarette end butts and matchsticks. And when the doctors, American Jackson, the British doctor, saw this, they were horrified. They insisted on us soaking that overnight in the cauldron to let the offal float to the top and take it out. But when the guards caught us doing that, The minute I stopped doing it, they said, you've got to eat what the Japanese give you to eat. So for a while, we had to eat it as it was, with the matchsticks and fag ends included in our so-called diet.
So hunger was the, I suppose, the major...
And trying to keep sane, because it was insanity, was another thing. The number of Americans, oddly enough, the few British in that Itchiok hospital stood up to it better than the Americans. Americans went insane very quickly. They didn't have the same some stomach as we had for it all. They seemed to give in easier. They never thought they were going to get out of that alive. They thought they were there till they died. Whereas we kept telling them, Americans would get us out, the British will eventually. We kept telling them that.
What happened if people went crazy?
Oh, we had to hold them down and try any old way. No injections. You had to knock them out sometime. Just hit them, knock them out. And it was so easy to knock someone out in that condition. You just had to more or less touch them and they fell. You just hit them just lightly and down they went. It was just quite unbelievable, the treatment we got there. But then they started bombing at you, okay, the Americans did. Got no camps up there to stop it, you see. And
no Japanese air force?
No indication that we were a Japanese prison camp. No signs up, no POW camp signs.
Did you have any inkling of what was happening with the rest of the world? And the
yes,
war?
We did. We got snippets of information because, believe it or not, there was the old wizard amongst us who built radios and managed to conceal it, little things, but enough to get the odd bit of news. They even had them in part of a brush head. It was quite incredible where they had them, really, because you had to hide things from the Japanese in the most obvious places, like under a dome mat or something like this. That's the last place you think of looking. So this chap had this in this little tiny little receiver thing, which I don't know how he made it, with pieces of with all sorts of cigarette interior wrappings and things. He made this. I don't ask me how he did it, because I was a wireless operator and I had no idea I did it. But there was also, of course, civilian contacts, Japanese civilian contacts from people, Japanese who could speak English. And we found out later there were Christians who were talking to, who had the odd Christian Japanese soldier. And he used to talk to us about Jesus. Do you know about Jesus? We said, you know all about Jesus, you know. Of course, I told them about my own stories of this Japanese soldier called Benda-san. I remember him. He couldn't believe it when I told him my story about Hong Kong meeting Jesus in this prison camp. And he gave me the old Japanese Christian sign. We did get news, but it was just snippets about... that they were, of course, they didn't need to tell us. The bombings told us everything itself. But then we did hear in the end that Japan had surrendered, and that was horrific to us. We knew then that the writing was on the wall for us. But by this time, we'd also been told that we were to be exterminated as soon as an Allied foot stepped on Japanese island, because every man, woman, and child would be required to fight to the last Japanese person against the invaders. So we thought, God, is this how we're going? Another way we're going to finish our life? Because by this time I was in my late or middle 20s and getting on for my late 20s, you see. And
We're in 1944 now.
Are we 44 or 45? 44, into 44 by now.
In the winter of 44.
Yeah, 44.
And it was cold, I imagine. You know, you said people were getting frostbite.
That's right, yes, that was
awful.
How
did you keep warm at night?
It was awful. It really was. Well, it just kept on doing it, and it just, the number of arms and legs and fingers and hands that we took off was quite incredible, really. And these doctors, how they managed to do it, to sterilise this instrument, I devised a thing with a huge fruit can, a Japanese fruit can, that we managed, because we collected all cans as meat, because we had no cups and saucers, we had to just grab whatever we could on our working patches to act as utensils. And of course, the Japanese big utensils, let them think that was to use as spit platoons, you see, for the people who had chronic...
respiratory.
That's right, you see, all sorts of illnesses in the so-called hospital. And I'll tell you a story about that one spittoon that I'll tell you about in a minute. But we had these cans, so I got this huge fruit can, it was, that was used in a Japanese military hospital, I believe, for food. And I put a smaller can inside of it with a piece of glass at the bottom. And my training as a wireless operator in magnetics led me to believe that that would act as an insulation. And if I could get a positive to the outside, a negative to the inside, the electricity would try and cross the insulation and would create intensive heat in the surrounding water. And it worked. The only difference was that when it did happen, it roared the lighting in the, so it was a terrific resistance. It roared the whole lighting in the whole system, the whole camp, and I had to warn the whole camp about this, the doctors particularly, because if they were having a tenko at the time, it would create panic. So, but I said it would boil quickly, and it worked. So that's how they did their sterilizing of the equipment. Anyway, eventually we were bombed out of
there.
Sorry,
you were going to tell a story about a spittoon, you said.
Oh, the spittoons, yes. But this happened in the next camp.
Okay.
If I can come to that.
Oh, sure. No,
yeah, sorry.
Absolutely.
So we were bombed out of Ichioka, and we were taken to this building.
When you say you were bombed out, the place was
bombed. Yeah, we'll never forget the first day we saw the white silver bombs, planes come overhead. And we thought they were Russians at first. And they were quite high up. We could see they were silver. We knew they were big planes from the height. It wasn't until the next camp that we realised how big they were, B-29s. But in this other camp, this was a better hospital because it was an old American school that they'd had during the pre-war days in Japan. And we had proper rooms and proper bunks to sleep in for the first time, so we knew the war was nearly over by this time. Things were a lot more civilised than this, but unfortunately it didn't last very long. We're only in there just a matter of 2 or 3 months before we were bombed out of there as well. But while we were in there, we had the same sort of operations I was telling you about, just carried on the same. But we did get the odd bit of drugs in, now and again, we're trying to trickle in. The Japanese by this time were getting about worried about the extra food we were getting, and they were having to starve because they were on rations by this time as well, because our rice rations had improved a bit. And we were told that the vegetables soup that we were getting had to be used first of all to boil their veg in that they were given. So we had to boil their veg in our cauldron before we could do our own, and that we could have the sort of vegetable water afterwards to cover ourselves. Well, at first it was good, until we had an idea. We thought, why should we, we're getting enough now to survive now for what's left of the war, why should we bother about having what was left of that Japanese water to help us rice rising? Why not use it to our advantage? So we collected all the spittoon things that we used for all this. We had, I forget what they call that disease that made them cough up.
TB?
TB, yes, all that sort of thing, that's mm-hmm. right. And it was all this sputum that they brought
mm-hmm.
up.
Mm-hmm.
And there was loads of it, believe me, American. So before we took the rice out, we poured it all into the rice as it was steaming up. And made sure, because what we had to do was had to let it steam after a while, and boil for a while to steam. So before it steamed up, we poured all this into it, so that it got mixed up with the rice. And we just, when we had to shuffle this all, after about an hour, 2 hours steaming with the lid on it, after it had got, you know, about steamed in the water, we had to take the lid off then, take this rice out, nice flaky rice, I'm an expert by the way now in cooking Japanese rice, into these buckets which they carried off. And every time we saw them carry a bucket, we said, good old. So that was the way we got our revenge. So that would kill a lot of Japanese, I'm sure.
Was that rations for the military? Where did that
Well, we didn't, couldn't care. That's where it was going, really. But we knew it wasn't going to civilian population, because by this time, the civilian population was on rations itself now.
Did you get, was there any, as the end of the war became closer, did the behaviour of the Japanese guards towards you change?
Yes, some of them were changed. Can I go to the toilet, by the way?
Of course, yeah. Hang on a sec. Let me just stop it there.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, back to Ichioka again. Just before we were due to leave Ichioka, and because of the bombings, the Japanese still thought they would still win the war, by the way, but this made them more irate than ever, really. Particularly the commandant, who, by the way, was mostly under the influence of sake when he was taking his tenkos and reminding us of the extermination if the Allies ever landed on here. But on one occasion, he stood up on his little box, because, as you probably remember, the Japanese were very short people, more or less anyway, and they hated to look up to people. So they had to stand on a box so they could look down. And he carried this box with him to stand on. Every time he wanted to slap your face, I think he stood on this box. And during tenkos, he always stood in and gave us this lecture.
During what? Sorry, tenkos? What's that?
A tenko. Tenko is a roll call. Tenko is a Japanese word for roll call. And he brought on one morning, he brought on, for an 8 o'clock tenko, he brought on this little box of eggs. I don't know where he got the box from, but it wasn't a wooden box, it was a sort of just something made up. And he showed these eggs, ego, he said, ego, for me, for Horio. Horio is Japanese for prisoner, no. So we thought, well, so what? So why tell us? So anyway, it was just to help to annoy us, because he was angry with the bombing that was going on, and you know, any way they could get us, they did it. So off he went. The next day, he suddenly came into the camp in a rage, brandishing his sword out of its sheath, and when you wanted to do that, there was trouble on. And he had 6 guards with him, and he just went around picking on people. This was in a small camp, so it wasn't very difficult for him to pick 12 people, because they were mostly like myself. There were supposed to be orderlies in this so-called hospital. So he took 12 of us, and he made us line up in the parade ground part. And he put guards in front and behind us with their fixed bayonets pointing at us. We thought, what the hell's going on here now? We thought we were for it, really. And then he drew his sword and he said, someone has stolen my eggs. I'm going down this line and I'm going to take all heads off until I find out who's stolen my eggs. So he said, right, who's stolen my eggs? Nobody answered. Which, of course, we didn't know. We had a clue. How could we get to his bloody eggs? They were outside his camp. So after 3 occasions where nobody could answer him, he said, right, I'm going to start going down the line. I was 3rd in the line, by the way, at this case. And he then said to the first guy, an American, who was a great friend of mine, well, all of them were, really. They were all great friends of mine, because we came so close together in these camps. Told him to bend over. And they said, I'm going to ask you 3 times now again. Who stole my eggs? So he asked 3 times. No answer. So down came his sword, and it took this bloke's head off, and it was shocking. That's another thing I'll never forget, because one minute I knew that chap was stolen, and the next minute his head wasn't there. It was quite horrendous, really. And then he said to my real buddy, bend over. I thought, Christ, I'm next on the line too. So he made him bend over, and he said to him, first time, do you want to follow? He put it a bit differently this time. Do you want to follow your company next door to, or one Japanese, whatever that meant? Next door, he said, or do you want to be follow him? So he said, I'm going to ask you the same 3 questions. Who stole my eggs? No answer. Again, 3, who stole my eggs? I was waiting for that. Oh, God, I'm next. And then he said, just he was about to bring his sword down, on the 3rd occasion, champ, I called him, he said, you have just killed the poor sod, or what's to that effect? And I couldn't believe it. The guards, random, when it was a point of bayonet, they went hilarious. Probably because they knew who had stolen their eggs, one of them, for their own, their families were suffering with the rations. And the commandant, who was ready under the influence of sake anyway, he went, and they just ran off. But the last thing he said to us was, get rid of that headless body. But the head had come off quickly, by the way. The skin was still holding on to the neck, so it was quite horrific, really. But how can I forget things like that, you know? It was awful, that really was. Well, the champ just died last year, he did. And it's a pity that he wasn't alive, because he would have... It was him, really, that saved my life. When we got back to our beds, we were still under shock, all of us. Went back to our beds and we just lay there. And Dr. Jackson came in to pacify us, because he'd witnessed all this, waiting for the inevitable, I suppose, and nothing he could do about it. And I said to a chap lying next to me, I said, "Chap, why did you say that?" I said, "It wasn't him at all, we didn't know." He said, "My name was Jackson," that was a nickname they gave me. "Jackson, for God's sake, I had to think quickly," and he said he was dead anyway. And I thought,
Did he literally say, "You've just killed him, you poor sod, oh, you stupid sod"? What did he say to the Japanese?
No, I can't imagine the exact words.
No,
but it was along the lines of, "You've just killed the man who's told you," or was to that effect. It was quite incredible, that. So then we went, that
Sorry, Jack, still at Ichioka. I'm going to have to change disc now, because we're running out of disc. So can we stop just for a little bit? So that's the end of reel five.
Good stuff. Let's get this quickly changed over.